Like
I don't understand why you have to dig so deep into it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the one and only Mod State Podcast. Also found over at modstate.com, along with more op-ed and opinion pieces. I am happy to be here today. How about you, my friend?
Well, I was fine until you just prematurely knocked me off of my precast soapbox.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, but no. I'm good.
Apologies. Ah. No. Well, there are many good things to talk about here in the world. However, let me turn my phone to silent and sip some of this tea.
Is it actually tea?
It is actually tea. It's the like my go-to that's not coffee at close to 9 o'clock Mountain Time. So
yeah, it's probably not the best.
No, not at all.
I mean, for folks sensitive to caffeine.
That's the thing. Like, I wish I was more sensitive to caffeine. I am, but I'm just not now. I'm normally, after these podcast episodes and I'm getting ready for bed, I find myself sort of staring at the ceiling anyways, only because I'm just kind of reeling in what we talked about and you sort of get amped up. I mean, you have to really be engaged in these podcast episodes every single time. I mean, it seems like it gets easier and easier, but it's still quite a bit of like mental exhaustion, but the gears just are turning and turning. Excuse me.
It's a good kind of tired, but yeah, I've definitely, especially times when we did some, excuse me, man, we're both just dying here. When we've done these before, we've sat down and talked, and once we get going, though, fun.
Yeah.
But then after we've done some editing and the precast, and then 2.5 hours later, I'm like, holy. Yeah, I gotta lay down.
It's funny. I'm always, there'll be times where I'm kind of waiting, or you know, you're waiting, and we precast it and we're ready to go, and I'm like, oh my god, I am tired. But some of the best work I think we've ever had back and forth has been those days where I've been up for like 24 plus hours. It's like, nope, let's just do this. And for whatever reason, it just sort of happens. And that's why when we do these back to back podcasts, it's like, listen, I'm gonna hit pause and we're gonna hit the record button immediately after, because we just have to stay in the flow. Otherwise, you just sort of that.
Well, once we get into it, it's fine.
Exactly.
It's like when you play soccer or the football, you play with your feet, as I like to call it. When you play that out in the cold, at first it sucks, but then once you get moving, it's like, yeah, all right,
that's all right. Indeed.
Good.
Well, we
those of us who are box to box midfielders, that is.
Indeed.
Goalkeepers are screwed.
Yeah, you're just out in the cold. Just going to break a finger in
the cold.
You
have fun with that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there's plenty of things to talk about, and the one thing I brushed over, and so maybe we can just discuss this briefly before we get into what I think is a fairly interesting geopolitical conversation, is, you know, there's two big things that happened today. And I say today because many people listen to these podcasts later on. I actually found, interestingly enough, when you go back and look at the metrics, that there are podcasts from 6 months ago that get more hits than the current podcasts we put out. So I always find that really interesting. And I think it's good that we went away from the format of what we'd called the midweek wrap, where we're really talking about the news that enveloped that week. Not that it's not relevant, but it doesn't hold the same weight 6 months later that a lot of these individual topic-based podcast episodes really do garner. So, with that,
we've trimmed back a lot of the gunslinging.
Yeah, to which I think is
probably for the best.
Hopefully, more meaty, substantive.
We're not doing a podcast for 90 minutes anymore, folks. So we hope we're not losing you. It's concise.
Substantive podcast.
Yeah, I smell what you're stuffing in. Yeah, I'm drinking Ultra Boring.
I got you. Okay. Well, the first thing, before getting into the geopolitics of withdrawing from Syria, it was of note that the Federal Reserve did increase interest rates today. And from a blooming economist as yourself, you know, I'm curious your thoughts. But I indeed, it's funny to watch
rates have to go up.
They have to. And I'm not an economist, but I definitely track the markets and follow this stuff with some interest. And it there are a couple things. I mean, one thing that
is nothing personal. They do that without concern for political optics.
Exactly, as they should.
And the board is supposed to.
Yeah. And what I find is interesting is we, you know, as a middle class individual, and there are middle class folks out there that do watch the markets. I'm not exceedingly wealthy at all, but there are one thing that we didn't touch on a lot this year was the fact that this was the 10th year post the Great Recession, and we have had a booming economy. But I think a lot of people.
We haven't peaked yet.
We haven't peaked yet. There's Always Sunny from Philadelphia line that I want to interject there, but I'm not going to. So anyway.
No.
You haven't begun to see me peak.
There's always going to be a massive run up before the turndown.
Mm.
It hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't. And just because the Feds increase interest rates by 2%, obviously
that means it's growing faster than they'd like.
And they'd like it to. And so the point is to, I mean, and
they're going
to
raise them again.
If you're looking at like a manufacturing corporation or just a corporation in general, like obviously what that does is
you pay a few more cents every few dollars or so.
Yeah, your interest rates does affect the borrowing.
Your cash
and
flow.
And that does represent in your quarterly reports, or if in due time probably won't.
Well, it affects your books. I mean, it affects your viability. I mean, companies like Microsoft it'll be interesting to see what they do in the future, but to buy Skype and LinkedIn, they borrowed money because it was cheaper than paying the taxes, simply to buy them outright with cash.
Indeed. So that will change. And then, of course, you know, like in general, the Fed is just checking an economy that is doing very well, and interest rates should increase. Now, there's
3% growth at the first quarter of the year.
There's already these predictions that there's going to be a recession in 2020. But you know what? You're right. Like the corporate tax rates, maybe in for a better sense of the sort of their steam has resided. But that, you know, that's also fueled. You know, been fueled by a couple other things, and that could be, you know, whether that's a trade war. Brexit is looming in March.
There was $500 billion in expatriated tax revenue. The Trump administration predicted $1 trillion. There was $500 billion in expatriated tax revenue. Still not a small, it's not chump change by any means.
No, it's not a shabby number.
We're also going to see, this is the first full year in which we're going to be filing under the new tax law, everyone.
Mm-hmm. So
it's this April. So we'll see on that. But as far as the borrowing, the borrowing rate is not going to discourage. There's going to be a plunge in people that are doing things akin to day trading as far as the spirit of that. If you're doing that, yeah, you're going to lose. And you're going to lose big. But as far as the overall curve of the market, it is nowhere near. I don't know that we'll peak before the election.
Yeah. And beyond that, I mean,
they're going to keep raising rates, period.
Yeah, I think some people now, I mean, big time investors, hedge fund managers, and the 1% obviously feel this differently than the middle class does, because, I mean, in terms of the last 10 years.
I'm sorry. Did you just say the 1% could feel something?
Oh, well, yeah, they do have hearts, my friend. Though cold they may be. It's interesting to see sort of sentiment post-recession, and I'll be honest, like I was fairly insulated from the effects of the recession. I mean, my day job has never really been affected by the recession, and if I hadn't joined the military, probably wouldn't have been affected that much either. Healthcare is one of those very special niches where people will just always be sick, and you'll always need care.
Weren't you talking about growing cannabis if you hadn't become a nurse?
Hey, maybe. You know? It would have been prime time to get out here and do that. But
well, I mean, hasn't Detroit gone that way? Aren't there and abandoned properties? Aren't they? Haven't they been farming pot?
Michigan. Well, yeah. So city proper, it's still all medical. They decriminalized it, but it's still all medical. I mean, they just passed.
The point is, you got people out there farming that shit in public.
Oh yeah. Well, still warehouses. Farming.
Okay, but you know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about it in like businesses. It's not like they're afraid of being raided.
No, not in Detroit. But you know what? That really doesn't have a great 401k plan, so probably wouldn't venture down that road.
Okay. Who's making enough money to really sock money away into a 401k that's willing to grow a pot?
That's a good question. I mean, there's some people that have a healthy retirement, but it's all in cash. Well, real estate now, probably. But
yeah, exactly. It ain't a 401k.
Nah. But either way, I think what is interesting post-recession is that you have seen an accumulation of wealth in that, and I'm not using the term equitably as in some sort of political policy that it should be, but I think there's a lot of people that left this recession still obviously very dubious and suspicious of big business. Obviously, big business got some bailouts, but the one thing you found, it's just now starting to happen a little bit. And I think that has to do with the unemployment rate as well, that as more individuals are able to find jobs, businesses are actually struggling to hire people. So that workers can actually demand more higher wages. So it isn't until maybe the last year, year and a half, 2 years that you've actually seen the wages adjust, moving to where they probably should be in terms of.
They definitely are at this point. It is trending up.
At this point.
For now.
And that's what I hope to see, because I think.
I hope it's sustained.
I hope it is too. And I hope it continues to get to a point where, you know, you're seeing the housing. Sort of a housing slump, and that obviously
it's criminal the way Amazon and Walmart pay their employees.
It is.
100%. I mean, not literally, but
no, but yes, figurative. Yes, it is 100%. And I mean, they're like, well, here's the interest rates. Will that do anything for the average potential future home buyer? Like, no, interest rates don't necessarily. No. It's not that it makes it harder.
Not at this range.
Yeah, it's not that it makes it harder to purchase.
Well, you're talking about a far greater. You're talking about like in the 80s when it was in the teens.
Yeah, the teens. It's not that, because like when I purchase my home, the difference between 4% and 5% and the interest that I have to put down monthly. I mean, it's not. It doesn't hurt, but it's really the.
It was fairly negligible.
Exactly, it's the debt that's incurred by a lot of people in my generation that precludes them from being able to save the money to purchase homes.
Not to mention, about people that lost homes.
Yeah, well, people that lost homes, that lost their wealth, it just put everybody behind in a new generation, our generation.
It was our generation. It didn't happen to you and I, but it happened to a lot of millennials.
It did. Well, I think millennials are sort of caught in this crossfire that, you know, so wages haven't exactly adjusted fairly on top of entering a market that was incredibly difficult to enter and incurring that student loan debt that needed to be paid back. So it just put them at an unfair advantage in the first place. So, and then everyone suffered from the wage stagflation over the past decade, and more specifically beyond this decade, that just has made it incredibly difficult for, you know, the middle class.
You know how I've long felt here about this, and I'll say it again because I haven't actually said it in quite some time regarding student loan debt, but we're able to bail out New York City, which we did in the 1970s. We're able to bail out the auto industry when no one bailed out American Motors. And then we're able to go on and bail out the very banks that engaged with Congress in a conspiracy. Mm. You know this is true. This is not a conspiracy that's unheard of, folks.
No.
To lend money, amounts of money, sums of money to folks that had no business borrowing that much money, and then have a variable interest rate. You know, if the market dictates, bullshit, if you dictate. So the rates go up, people can't afford the house. So the bank wins in the end anyway. They have your equity, they have the property back. The problem was then they screwed over too many middle and lower income people. Mm-hmm. And there was nobody, the properties were worthless. So they screwed themselves. But guess what? The American taxpayers still bailed them out. Mm. At the end of the day, they were too big to fail. Lehman Brothers and company. Okay. The way we address that, okay, that inequity, since the founding fathers weren't planning on any of this anyway, I can't really look at it from those optics, even as a laissez-faire thinker. So with that, I've long maintained we forget the whole lot of it. We pay it out. We bail out. You want to bail out the American people? And you know, Senator Ted Cruz has the temerity to stand up and say that that's congressional overreach. Is it?
Yeah. And so the question then becomes, what is congressional overreach if you've got this
really?
Track record? Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I mean.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so, I mean, of course, I also am of the mindset to sell that the federal government has no business owning the vast majority of the state of Arizona, for example. So, you know, you don't agree with the land sales, but it's trillions of dollars.
It is.
You know, there's a lot of optics that don't necessarily look pretty, but that we could do to get fiscally smart in this country and get on the right track. But that's a different podcast.
Man, you're just all over the political spectrum in the first 15 minutes of this podcast. I love it.
Well, I just, you know, you mentioned killing the midweek wrap, and it made me long for those days briefly, but back on track. Sorry.
Indeed. Well, let's move away from interest rates and get on to the geopolitics. That being that our president of the United States has made a unilateral, and I could maybe say a true unilateral, well, it's really a campaign promise to officially get our troops out of Syria, as he would call it, our young boys, girls, men and women, I believe that's something along to paraphrased, out of Syria. Now, this came as a bit of a shock to the broader maybe I say national security / military DOD personnel. Now, we're talking about Syria. He didn't say we're going to pull out of every conflict all over planet Earth. That's not what he said at all. But it is his, he was adamant that American troops must come home from Syria. Now, he had announced this in Ohio just recently, and he's obviously been touting this since he was campaigning. However, what's interesting is that his military national security advisors kind of told him that the move was a bit rash and unwise, to which he then kind of countered with a, well, I'll give you 6 months. So it seems now that we are planning for the withdrawal, and it sounds like it's happening almost like right now.
They've started the withdrawal.
Which is, it just leads us to, it leads me to pause and just look at a bit of our recent history. Now, before we get in here and talk back and forth on the geopolitics of this, you know, I must...
We're talking about nearly two decades of warfare there with what you could be referencing, so we don't have time for that.
That's very true. However, it regardless of what is happening in Syria and what could happen in Syria beyond this, is that it just takes me back, and I'm not picking a side here. I'm merely just, it's almost like a brainchild. It's a stream of consciousness, if you will, on my thoughts on this.
Let it drop.
It isn't as, first off, before we even begin this, who's the biggest loser in this entire thing?
The Kurds.
I mean, if you geopolitically speaking, the Kurds.
Yes, it's the largest. Loser. It's the world's largest ethnic group without its own state.
Yep. So if there's people probably concerned beyond the Kurds, or looking beyond the Kurds as who potentially really suffers here, and I think a lot of people will point to the Syrian people, with the Assad regime potentially having stronghold or creating a stronghold again, without U.S. backing. Now, I think it was posited by an official that said, and I think President Trump had. Actually talked to Israel about this, and Netanyahu seemed fairly confident that the United States would be able to exert its influence in the region fairly well without having troops there, which, you know, that's obviously in intelligence assets leverage.
That was in theory.
In theory, this is intelligence assets, this is sanctions, this is a whole host of things that the United States could do without military support. To which I say, military, having advisors and having military troops on the ground in places like this is a lot different than just sort of this.
Because you're talking about a difference in bodies.
Exactly, 100%, and real time intel, real
time.
You're
also talking about one makes a statement.
Very true. So beyond the Kurds, I had to look back at history and just think about what happened in Iraq when we left. Now, there are some not even subtle differences. There's some extreme differences in Iraq.
There was no massive state, much less two. Well, not massive. Both aren't massive, but
And there was a
one wants to be massive.
There was a semblance of a central government there that we at least agreed with.
Maliki.
And
Prime Minister Maliki.
Wow, yeah, that's a throwback name.
Malachi Mulaki, is that it?
Mulaki. I'm not, I don't know. So
he wasn't lucky.
He wasn't. That's true. So there was a central government there that we did agree with, and we did feel that even though they might not, obviously, clearly weren't successful, and I'm sure a lot of people playing Monday morning quarterback saying, well, yeah, we knew that was going to happen, but it was still a government that we believed in. There is no government there in Syria that we believe in. The second is there wasn't the proxy wars in Iraq were very different from that.
Oh, they're far more limited in scope.
Yes, in Iraq at the time. There were proxy wars.
I mean, look at Aleppo. For God's sake, for one thing, to those people, I would say, all right, this is in the dozens of times your city has been just completely destroyed. Maybe it's time to babble on this thing and give up.
Yep.
Okay.
So
on the next note, they've gone through that city almost neighborhood to neighborhood in some cases, killing people.
Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting. You might ask,
bloodbath and savagery. Jesus.
People might ask me, so what's your point? Does that mean that it's an okay thing to do in Syria? To which I say, no, let me make the correlation here, because it seems like I'm making some sort of comparison. And
it seems like just making a case for war or something.
Does sound like that a little bit. But here,
a bit.
When we left Iraq, I'm not making a case for anything. I'm just sort of pointing out historically what happens when we do leave places. And
going to arrive at what you think we should do, yes?
Possibly. Because I'm not, okay. This is a stream of consciousness, so I don't know the solution necessarily.
You hop in that stream, Nate. Just hop on in.
Well, you just follow along. So,
James.
The next part of this, and I said, so there is, because of the limited proxy wars that were in Iraq at the time, we did leave a massive vacuum. Now, that vacuum did not become occupied by established foreign governments. That obviously was occupied by a caliphate and a religious extremist group that then we were able to go in and help the Iraqi government and kind of clean up our mess that we created. Now, the difference in Syria is all those things. That there is no vacuum if we just leave.
Actually, the Russians that made a mess this time.
Well, or part of it. So with the proxy wars that we have,
they enabled the biggest part.
Exactly. So when you leave troops, so for example, let's just look at the geopolitics in Syria. Right now, the Turkish government and Erdogan and the Turks in general see the Kurds and label them as terrorists. And they are on the northern border of Syria with Turkey. They are considered terrorists. And it is up to Erdogan to appear tough and strong against the Kurds. Now, the Turks have always threatened to do something against the Kurds. But as long as military advisors in the special operation community was with the Kurds fighting in Syria, the Turks never did anything. Now, with the United States gone, there really is no buffer anymore. So that's strike one against the Kurds. The second is there would be a vacuum if the United States left. So that's not different from Iraq. The difference is...
Here you've got Iran and Russia
waiting
to swoop in.
Exactly. So it doesn't mean that Russia just moves in with tanks and occupies Syria. That's not the point.
They're already there.
They are already there, which is kind of a negative in the first place. But... There's things that
Jesus.
And obviously, who are the Russians backing? That's the other thing as well.
In Soviet Russia, you show up late, you never show up again.
I have a Russian patient. He goes, look, do you understand? I don't understand what? You haven't even told me anything. Look, understand? Understand what, man? He has me, every now and then his phone goes down, and that's a touch screen. The problem is it's all in Russian. So he gives it to me and he goes, screen dark. I'm like, dude, I realize you forgot your glasses, but unless you give me a crash course in the Russian alphabet, I have no idea how to navigate your Android platform in Russian.
There's no way.
Nope. I've done it once. So anyway. So
that's 100% more than I have.
So the second part is who Russia is actually backing, and that is the Assad regime.
They use chemical weapons that President Trump responded with bombings on. Just
mm-hmm. Yep.
Keep that omnipresent. Indeed. Keep that looming.
So now, does the Russian presence helping the Assad regime, let's just say they crush the rebels that are there and that would incur more civilian deaths, etc.
Do they go after the Kurds next?
I mean, that would be, who knows if that would happen. But what I do know is that the Russian presence there isn't necessarily a negative for Syria altogether. And I don't mean that in a positive, in a pro-Russian type of stance. But the one thing that a lot of the U.S. Advisors to the president had said is like, look, part of our job there was to help rebuild, which God knows we've been doing that for 20 years in Afghanistan. But we really are leaving this infrastructure completely untapped and unfixed.
Yeah, it's been tapped.
Yeah, sure has been tapped. But if you're
going to leave that one alone for the sake of decency.
If you're afraid of Russian intervention and Russian stronghold there, this is a perfect opportunity for Russia to move in and
just
look like the good
at.
Guy and just stay where they're at and build up the infrastructure there. Now, why is that potentially dangerous? Because A, it's an established government, and B, it's a government, an established government that would like to enact Soviet Union era influence around the world.
And
which
that's
means,
what Vladimir Putin wants, even though he can't have it right now in Russia.
And
make no mistake, folks, he wants to be a czar.
And he can't do it in Ukraine, so...
He wants to be a premier, excuse me.
Yeah, exactly. He can't do it in Ukraine or the Caucasus, so what better spot than Syria?
Yeah.
So, with a perfect ally in Assad, who would be very pro-Russian.
You know, why won't he try that in Serbia?
Why won't he? Oh, God.
Can you imagine the bloodbath?
Jesus. So anyway, these are just a number. I mean, we probably haven't even scratched the surface of the potential ramifications for this. Now, your next question is, beyond going into the other sort of nuances of all of this, I mean, there's also Iran, who shares a border with Syria as well. And maybe the Iranian, Russian sort of vying for influence in the region will actually be more confrontational than an ally.
You think Russia's going to try and compete with Iran?
I don't think they're, well,
they're allies. Russia's been backing them throughout we backed Iraq.
That's very true.
We backed Saddam Hussein in Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war. Russia backed Iran. And you see, what you're getting at is the U.S. withdrawing for the proxy wars there means this vacuum, somebody's going to have somebody to fight.
Well, so in, beyond fighting, just having influence in the region, right?
Well, that's what I mean. Just forget it'll be proxy wars. I don't mean head to head, but
well, so
you think Russia and Iran might develop competing interests with America gone?
Well, I think it's a potential because look, you can have allied ship until there's almost like an untapped territory, right?
What does Russia want that they'll take that Iran wants?
A port. On the Mediterranean.
So you think Aleppo is the issue?
I just think as a strategic. I mean, think of Damascus. I mean, that's biblical. That place is biblical. I mean, that is, and why was it so successful? Because it was a trading post. So it. I don't know that it's necessarily that Russia wants to take over Syria. That's not the point. But who gets? Okay, so when it comes down to two nations and their interests, like they might be a lot. They might have an allyship for a common interest, but then when that fight or that sort of obstacle is taken away, that allyship sometimes crumbles because now it is what is in the best interest of our nation. So now, could you see a symbiosis of Iran and Russia having ports in a place like Damascus? Probably not. It would be in the best interest of a country to be the most influential country or entity within that region. And so that's where I think that becomes interesting. So there could be conflict with Russia and Iran. I don't know what their combined allyship in Syria would look like and how that would be beneficial for the two countries, especially if the overall narrative of Putin is to reestablish the Soviet Union. How do you do that with this hand-in-hand partnership with Iran in a region that would be very strategic like Assyria? So, and you think like, why is Ukraine a place that would be strategic? Well, it's on a body of water. So, I mean, these are all just interesting geopolitical maneuvers. Now, the question then you ask me is, So then what would be your plan? And I'm that kind of guy. When you have a problem and you come to me, you better have a solution, even if it's not a good solution. Just at least it shows that you tried. But you can point all the problems out in the world, but it really sucks when you don't have
a... We're talking about you, Paul Ryan.
Oh, boy.
Had the nerve to deliver a farewell address.
Farewell. You should have given that 2 years ago. Oh, God. So, anyway.
That's being kind.
Yeah. So here's... The bottom line is I'm not advocating for more military intervention. And I really don't know what it looks like. It's me presenting...
You're advocating for a kinder and gentler Assad.
Well, oh gosh, wouldn't the world love that? So I don't know. And I think you brought up a good point in precast where you said, look, there's pretty much two options here. Well, there's three options. And the third option is the current status quo. And that's we're just there. And God knows for how long we would be there if we continued doing what we're doing, as if we'd make any headroom in this or headway in this endless proxy war.
That's right, it'd be just something to feed the military industrial establishment. All it would be.
Exactly. So the other two options are leave, or the second option is full on war. And
you're willing to take on Russia.
Yep, and dare Europe to enter the game.
And yeah, because Europe can't sit on the sidelines, and I mean, come on.
They'd have to pick
it's NATO but, here.
I mean, I guess they could, but that's kind of going against.
They're going against NATO,
pretty much. So, which is also interesting because Turkey is also part of that as well, which puts a little monkey wrench into anything that they
shouldn't
do with the Kurds. Which is
they're not opposing the Russians on any front for the whole purpose of NATO.
Exactly.
There's opposition to Russia.
So it would be a little weird for Turkey to do anything to the Kurds as they are a member of NATO. But I mean, you know what?
Don't even look at them, Turkey. Don't even look at the Kurds.
Just turn around.
Seriously, I'm serious. I'm a big supporter of the Kurds.
Yeah. And,
I don't want to go too far and get us banned here because I've gotten in trouble on Facebook and Twitter simply saying I don't want the Kurds all dead, basically.
Oh, how dare you?
Yeah, I mean, apparently I'm a monster.
God.
But I'm going to stop, seriously, before we get in trouble. Apple's going to be like, oh.
Pull it.
Guys, now, officer, I've seen drugs before, and I'm pretty sure these are drugs. Search.
Oh, boy. Anyway, so I've rambled for a while. What are your thoughts on the conundrum?
Well, I genuinely, my heart goes out to the Kurds. My heart goes out to the Syrian people as a whole. They're the real losers here. Afrin, Aleppo, Damascus. It's a friend of mine who used to work for the Republican Jewish Liberty Caucus in D.C. and he's back teaching school. He's out of the game in Wisconsin, enjoying the private sector life. And he has two grandparents that survived the Holocaust, one of which was at Auschwitz. And he said, this is the worst humanitarian crisis since then, which is a massive statement. Hmm. And I'll shift gears here as a moment. As a Roman Catholic, I look at this and go, I don't want bloodshed. I don't. I believe that all life is precious. However, with a capital comma, sometimes we have to consider protecting life and making moves to do that, and that means using force. And we did it in World War II, and I believe the right thing to do here is a military confrontation in Syria. That's the right thing to do.
Essentially a one and done.
Wait, right. Go in, Russia, get the hell out. If you're not getting out, we're going to make you get out. Iran, and take your lap dog with you, Iran. Or, we're going to fight and drive them out, period. Do what we did, prior to the Marshall Plan. Get them out, set up a government, and, that means Assad better see a priest.
Yeah.
Assad's days, quite literally, are numbered, is what that means. I mean, war crimes, anyone? Milosevic has got convicted for far less. And we set the Serbs up to fail. So, another story. But, point being here, that's what I think the right thing to do is. What is politically coherent here? I don't know in terms of political optics what the goal is here.
Do you...
My problem with an extension, my thing is you either withdraw yesterday or you start a war, this business of giving them a date. So all they got to do is play the long game.
Oh, indeed.
Or opposition.
And the real question when you say, when you're talking about political optics, I mean, the real question is this something that American people could get behind if you posit it that way and said, look, this is one and done. This isn't some George Bush war on weapons of mass destruction, Colin Powell speech. This isn't
Donald
this,
Trump could do this.
This isn't 9/11. This is, look, we need to get this done, and we can't have Russian influence. We can't have Iranian influence. We need to get it done.
He's the president who could do this.
Yeah, and which is interesting because his sort of libertarian move or progressive move, either however you want to put it, actually had quite a bit of pushback from the GOP, who have been fairly reluctant to go against him in the past. And now all of a sudden you've got Lindsey Graham coming out saying this is a mistake. I mean, now's the time. I mean, obviously changing course would look weird, but he actually probably could garner some support for this.
He could also, not that this is a reason to start a war, but from just pure, vulgar, crass, gross political terms, all right, the fact is the country does, in the event of a serious armed conflict, and I believe state-on-state warfare with Russia would qualify, does tend to, the public rallies around the president. This is a political opportunity here. Now, that is not the reason to go. And no. If I was in the room with him, I would not bring it up. And I would be, if I was in the room again and somebody that mattered, I would be ready to cuss out the person that said that. Don't goad this man into doing this.
It could happen.
Okay. Well, seriously, that's not the reason. I say American boys because it'll be primarily American boys and for other countries, their sons that are coming home in boxes, okay? But you commit our people to war, make it count. And he's the president that could do this for the Syrian people, for the Kurds. We could address that issue. I mean, I think we should have addressed that issue a long time ago in Iraq and split it into three countries, and one of which would have been Kurdistan. They didn't go that route. And I think in the long run, it was a mistake. It is a mistake. We're still living that mistake. Let's not replicate it. But let's not make an even bigger mistake in the long run. I mean, forget the ruins that are beyond preservation now. The history gone from that time, from biblical times, because of this. Beyond relics. We're talking about lives here. The extermination of a people for simply being born as what they are.
Not to mention the mass relocation of a huge chunk of their population as well.
The humanitarian crisis is appalling. It's catastrophic.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it definitely, you know, sort of in conclusion of this, I mean, there are a number of ways to go. Obviously, the president has made this unilateral decision to move in the direction of bringing everyone home, which to a lot of people is a good thing. And I'm not saying it's bad. You know, I don't like military members in conflicts where they could lose their life for something silly, and not silly because the mission itself is not. I mean, I've had plenty of friends that have been in Syria.
In terms of our country's overall well-being,
I guess my thing is
financially, it's not.
It's either you're all in or you're all out, and to lose a life over something half-assed is far less memorable and harder to swallow than being in or out. And I think that's...
Yeah, I don't want a Lebanon, but I don't want a Damascus 1983, but I also don't want a Vietnam.
Exactly. So, well, with that, my friend, we're rushing up on 40 minutes here, and I think that's a solid place to stop. So
it could get us in trouble.
We could get in far more trouble talking more about this, but...
Yeah, you bring up the Kurds again, and I'll get banned.
This has been a riveting geopolitical conversation. We have not had one of these in a while, so...
It's been a long time since we rock and rolled.
That's right, man. So, with that, my friend, until next time.
Au revoir.
We'll see ya.